KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19. Live from the Jefferson County Courthouse, this is KPTZ, Fort Townsend.
Purple Air has a place to go get information about air quality, and Willie's is a much better place because Purple Air is not compensated, so you'll get higher reading than are accurate, but the fire.airnow.gov is a great place, and I have it up now looking at the smoke all over and around us. So
I'm glad you brought that up. Can I just comment on that real quick? I'm hearing a lot of concern about this. So from my time on ORCA, I learned a lot about air quality. That's the Clean Air Agency. So the purple air does not compensate for humidity difference in humidity levels. So that's why we get one reading on purple air. And then the state and the federal air quality guidelines are different, and they're measured differently based on particle size. So a lot of people are saying, why am I getting such vastly different readings? So it depends if it's a federal site, you're getting the 5 micron threshold. At the state level, it's 2.5, and at purple air, you're getting 2.5, but with humidity compensated for. So it's confusing, excuse me. But I think as long as people are looking at the same site and looking at trends of up and down, it can still be helpful, but comparing cross sites can be really confusing.
And the feds actually use the purple air data in the fire.airnow.gov. You'll see the same measuring spots in Fort Townsend. They're both purple air, or one of them is a purple air monitor, but they've got an algorithm to compensate for the testing or the reading imperfection in purple air. So yes, fire.airnow.gov. And with that, let's welcome the listeners from KPTZ. And standing in for Dr. Locke, we have our public health director, Vicki Kirkpatrick. Hello, Vicki. Thanks for joining us this morning, as well as Willie Vince, our emergency management director. So we'll start off with Vicki, and welcome to the listeners from KPTZ. And Vicki, how are we doing this week?
Well, we have one new case since last week that we received late Friday. No new cases over the weekend, which is good. So the number of cases is still low and trending low. Many of our cases came off of isolation, and many of our contacts that we were following came off of quarantine this last week as well. So right now, I would say that we are still in a bit of a lull, even though we did have one new case. So the big thing probably this last week was the first week of full week of school. And some of our schools are having a hybrid or some in-person, some online. And I would say, while there were questions and things that came up, I would say all in all, it went well. From a COVID-19 perspective, from in terms of questions and process and protocol, Dr. Locke did put together a protocol for both providers at Jefferson Healthcare and for the school districts in relationship to what to do if a child or a staff member presents with COVID-like symptoms, how to go about contacting Jefferson Healthcare for testing, and for the school, specifically for the schools, both the children and staff at the schools. There will be, increased access to testing opportunities should they be needed. So this is all new to everybody, and at least based on what I am aware of and have heard, like I said, while there were questions, it in general went well, and the schools are have their plans in place, and were prepared and ready to go. So far, it looks good. I think the wildfire smoke is a challenge to all of us, because it seems like what we would typically say to protect yourself from wildfire smoke is actually sort of at odds with what we would tell you to protect yourself from COVID-19. So there is information that's come out. Department of Health has some on their website, EPA has some on their website, et cetera, about how to protect yourself and your family from both wildfire and COVID-19. I don't have a whole lot of other information at this point. We continue to work. Dr. Locke is continuing to meet with the school superintendents weekly, and we are getting contacted by them for assistance, and that's what we intend to continue to provide as we learn as we go along. We also know that we continue to prepare for the eventual approval of a COVID-19 vaccine. Generally, among the public health community, we don't necessarily expect that to be available this year, or at least not until late this year, but more likely next year. And it will probably come out to the state with very specific guidelines on priority, who receives the vaccine first, et cetera. But there's a growing concern among the general population that they don't want to see a vaccine come out and be approved until it's been through its clinical trials. And I think that's understandable. And as a result of that, based on some mixed messaging around having a vaccine out by November, polls show that the general public, that less than 50% of the public has indicated they would accept the vaccine, because there is concern about those clinical trials. And so hopefully the powers that be will make the decision to make sure that those clinical trials are completed before actually sending a vaccine out. But in the meantime, local public health and State Department of Public Health are working on our vaccine distribution plans and where the vaccine would be given and how to access that, and then eventually what the federal government decides the prioritization is for providing those vaccines. So that's really primarily what the update that I wanted to give today. So I'm open certainly for questions, and then we can go through the KPTZ listener questions as well.
I have two quick questions, and then you see what else. But one, we talked about it a little bit earlier, but wondering if you have any insight as to what the timeline might be for Jefferson Healthcare's South County testing capacity, or at least collecting tests down there. Are we talking a matter of weeks or months, days?
They are, in our last meeting with Jefferson Healthcare, they indicated that the Colesine Clinic is actually ready for any students or staff that might need testing. And if from the general population, if there are people who are unable to make it to Port Townsend for their testing, Jefferson Healthcare can make arrangements for that testing to be in the clinic in Colesine. The access is still through the respiratory clinic phone number. And they are preparing, but not quite ready yet, as I understand it, to provide the same service in the Port Ludlow Clinic. So it's not, I don't think it's a matter of weeks. I think it's probably a matter of days, maybe a week or so for Port Ludlow. But my understanding is that Quilcene is ready.
That is great. So
yeah.
To paraphrase you, initially it's mostly for school needs, at least down in South County. They stand up capacity, but you'll always call the same number to get to the nurse hotline and respiratory clinic to get a recommendation, and then you can advocate at that point to get that test collected down in Quilsey or within a week or so of Fort Leslie.
Exactly.
Great.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I have one question, and this is maybe just my optimism showing through, but we've talked a little bit about, you know, breathing issues and having breathing centers open for people in the smoky days that we're in right now. And wondering, is there any possibility of applying to the state for phase three again so we can get our libraries open?
We've heard no indication that the state is ready to consider movement beyond where we're at right now. So your guess is as good as mine at this point, Commissioner, because we've not heard anything. We've not heard anything about opening up the application process for moving to the next phase. And I would assume, since our particular county is looking, you know, is doing well right now, that we would be one of the first to hear that we could make that movement. And we've got no information related to that.
And I know some counties, as we were, you know, back and actually moving through phases, you know, proactively submitted their application before they were allowed to apply. And I'm wondering, since we have such lower, you know, rolling numbers than many of the phase three counties around us, if it would service at all, as we have a Board of Health meeting coming up, to have a conversation about whether we should proactively apply just for the safety of our citizens. Because I feel at this point, the limited number of access, or limited amount of access that we gain with phase three is going to be really kind of an equity access that's important to maintain safety and public health in our community.
I think that's an interesting question. I mean, technically the state has our phase three application. We did submit it and then they placed it on hold. My understanding is that they will be revising the application process. If that's the case, then we would need to find out whether or not that application exists at this point in time, or whether they will accept the applications that are already in to move to the next phase, and then just begin to process again once they decide that we can do some of that forward movement.
Right. Even if they were to continue to deem valid our existing application, wouldn't we still need to, one way or the other, freshen our metrics?
Yes, they would ask for updated information, certainly. And that's one of the areas where we had heard that they might be making some changes, and that is in the area around metrics. So, you know, what I can do is do a follow-up this week with the State Department of Health and find out where they are in even considering moving, opening up and moving, allowing the counties to move to the next phase.
I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Especially with, it seems like statewide numbers are leveling off nicely, too. So I'm curious about the appetite at the state level for that. Can I jump in with a question, Greg?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if this will be for Vicki or for Willie, but curious, Vicki, last year, I believe, or perhaps it was 2018, when we last had, you know, this pour of air quality, there was discussion about kind of being prepared for these kinds of air quality events. I remember specifically talking about having the authority to cancel events and that kind of thing. But I believe, too, we did discuss the need for clean air spaces available, especially for the underhoused. Is that something that is being discussed in either of your departments? We have gotten a number of emails and questions regarding resources for people who need to get out of this air quality.
I can actually...
Oh, go ahead, Blake.
Well, and so, yeah, we have, both within DEM and public health, we have discussed this, and obviously having a pandemic where fresh air is actually very helpful versus this kind of air quality, they conflict with one another greatly and complicate things quite a bit. But we have been discussing the potential need for a clean air shelter. Unfortunately, though, the air quality has been bad, but it's not been at the levels seen within the Seattle metropolitan area or in the Portland metro area. Just for example, in Portland today, they have announced that the county officials don't want anyone to be outside. And if you must work outside, you have an N95, you drink water, you take breaks, etc. Just before this meeting, I checked the air quality in Port Townsend. We were at 195. Portland was at 405 on the 0 to 500 scale. So fortunately, air quality has been bad, but not so dangerously unhealthy as it's been in other areas. We've been more at the level where if you simply avoid strenuous activity, avoid hikes, runs, and working outside if you can, you're more than likely to be okay. But in lieu of a clean air shelter, though, we did get permission from FEMA to use and distribute some of the N95s that we had available for the unsheltered population. So if they, we asked law enforcement and our partners in fire that if they knew of any unsheltered communities or individuals who might be struggling in this weather, we were able to provide them with an N95 to help mitigate against some of the unhealthy air that they weren't able to get safe from. I thought that was a decent alternative. Again, we don't have a lot of great spaces to open up a clean air shelter during a pandemic to maintain social distancing, all that kind of stuff. If we were in phase three, the library would be absolutely perfect. But just given the air quality that we're seeing, the limits of COVID-19, we felt that N95s will go a long way towards helping mitigate some of their issues.
How are those going to be distributed, Willie?
Via law enforcement, fire, we reached out to OLECAP as well. Some of those first response partners, they know where these communities are. They know how to reach out to them. So we're going to be hoping that they're going to be able to do a little proactive investigation and distribute those around.
Any other questions, Kate?
No, but I am concerned. I am not even sensitive to air quality generally, but in the last week have had pretty significant reaction to it, and have been wearing an N95 every time I'm outside, and I am concerned. We have empty spaces sitting around, and I would just hope that if space were made available, that we would be in a position of helping, especially ensure kind of safe practices and distancing. I think given the news today that this does not appear to be letting up anytime soon, that I'm not sure that it's our responsibility to be doing this, but I certainly think that it would be the right thing to do to help create a safer space to be.
So are you talking about like a place like the rec center or something, find some staff and open it up, that kind of solution?
Yes, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of an unused space right now because we're not congregating for good reason, and I totally recognize the risk of encouraging congregation. I'm just surprised at how uncomfortable it is for someone with a very healthy respiratory system who has a home to go to, but still am pretty affected by this. So for folks, especially those who are, carrying all of their belongings on their back and walking the hills of Port Townsend, I think it is realistic to think that there are health impacts for that population.
Yeah, I mean, we can continue to talk about it through the day, of course. But are there any other questions, I guess, right now for Vicki before we turn it over to Willie and perhaps a deeper conversation about this?
So, Vicki, am I correct that we would need to move into phase three to be able to open up some of those congregate spaces for air, or is that something we could do anyway?
That is a really good question, and I don't necessarily have the answer for that. The concern, of course, with opening up a space is the assuring the distancing can still happen. So the 6-foot distancing and the wearing of masks that are required in any internal location would continue to be a requirement regardless of what location that might be. One of the confounding factors is even with phase three and the lower, phase three lowered their gathering requirements to no more than 10 that's not in the immediate household versus the 5 in phase two, but phase three came down from 50 to 10 in an indoor setting. And so that's still part of the mandate even under phase three. So it would, I think, by necessity involve having multiple locations in order to, potentially if there was, you know, there was a need and a desire, you know, to keep people distanced.
I do know that King County opened a clean air shelter and they are not in phase three.
True, yes.
Yes, and indoor quality can vary a lot too. It's not necessarily innately better than being outside. It really depends on your filtration and what you have inside. There's a lot of things that give off different things, like if you have a propane stove, you get a little emission, and you know, each little thing adds up. And I think it could be deceiving just to differentiate insides better than outside, because that's not necessarily true, is it?
Well, I know that, you know, just in reading the How to Make Your Home Safer, one of the, particularly given COVID, the pandemic as well, one of the things that is not recommended are ozone type systems because ozone in itself is an irritant. But there are some recommendations for internal, which is shutting off the outdoor air and using a heavy duty filter and recirculating air. You know, typically we would want it vented outside for COVID-19, but not for the smoke. So the recommendation is a MER 13 level filtration system. If your furnace can handle that, and recirculated air internally, but not ozone or electrostatic filtration systems, because those in and of themselves can then be irritating.
And does anything have more up and down fortunes than ductless heat pumps right now? They're horrible for ventilation. Now they're great for keeping your air inside.
It's hard.
That, you know, cooking inside is a huge form of pollution too. You know, that there have been studies done. A Thanksgiving dinner will make your kitchen air quality worse than New Delhi. So no stir frying, use your oven as little as possible right now, you know. Go light on your internal world as well.
I see that Dr. Locke has arrived. I don't know if he would have anything to add on the air quality issue.
Awesome. Welcome, Dr. Locke.
Oh. I just finished my other talk. And I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. It's really all about limiting exposure. You know, you can't change the atmosphere that's around you, but you can modify the amount of exposure, and you can, you know, prevent adding other things to it, like smoking and cooking fumes and Things like painting or anything that involves aerosols, deferring that kind of work until the air quality improves.
Yeah. So, Dr. Locke, what we've been talking about was more of a focus on the unsheltered population. And Willie has also described efforts that EOC is making with Law of Fire and HolyCap to distribute N95 masks for the homeless.
Okay. Considering whether a clean air center is something that we should be considering, not just in this emergency, but also to have at the ready if we should have a plan, I think, that we can say, oh, turn the clean air center on. I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think these kind of events, you know, wildfires that I heard the governor refer to, proposed calling these climate fires instead of wildfires because they're, you know, it's going to be kind of the new normal at this time of year, and unless a bunch of things change. And so, yeah, being prepared for them is a good thing. And with masks and with places where people can get into an environment where there's filtered air. The extra challenge of all of this is it works against all these things we're trying to do with COVID-19, where we're trying to, encourage people to be outdoors and to leave their windows open and to set their ventilation systems on maximum air exchange. So this is a extra and unwanted challenge to the school reopenings, is that having to limit the amount of outdoor air exposure.
Great. And then we were just to the point, I think Vicki was going to address the KPTZ questions. I don't know how, if we're going to pass the mantle, or Vicki, you want to?
I'm always happy to pass the mantle to our expert on this. I did just send you those questions, Dr. Locke. I don't know if you've seen them.
I did see them. And,
okay.
It's actually, I finished a little early on my other talk, so I thought I should log on in case you you wanted some backup on those. The main ones, it seemed like people were talking about asking about vaccinations, which is great. We're really making a push this year for people to get vaccinated. There appears to be an ample supply of vaccine.
That's for flu now.
Yeah, for influenza, and we have some reason to hope that we'll have a relatively mild flu season, and that's what happened in the Southern Hemisphere. So Australia, New Zealand, South America, they had record low levels of influenza. Because of all the things they're doing to control COVID. So the masking and the distancing and the hand hygiene. As we kind of anticipated, that's very effective at preventing transmission of flu and common cold viruses. But it's really important this year we do the best job ever, and that is, among other reasons, it's because anybody with respiratory virus symptoms has to be tested, or at least we recommend that you be tested, because, you know, if you have COVID-19, we need to know about it for purposes of isolation and quarantine. And the more people that have respiratory symptoms, you know, the more stress it's going to be on the system to test them and to... like COVID-19, influenza is a killer virus, so people need to be hospitalized for it. People can die from it. So we're recommending that it's basically anyone over 6 months of age should get a flu shot. And the only reason you don't, if you're under 6 months, is because it doesn't work. Your immune system's not developed enough to react to the vaccine. But everyone else should get it. And The pharmacies will have it. The hospital will be doing some drive through vaccination programs. You know, it's just the supply is just starting to hit the system. So it's September and October are kind of the ideal months to do it. And we're not seeing any influenza around. So people have time to get vaccinated over the next 6 weeks or so. And there'll be a lot of different kind of venues. And if people are having trouble finding a place to get vaccinated, we'll work on that as a community to make sure everyone who wants to be vaccinated for influenza can get it.
Why is it that the pharmacies have it now, but Jefferson Healthcare doesn't yet? I guess that seems strange to me. And there was a question too about is there any advantage to waiting to get it, or if you get the vaccine now, is that going to cover you through this season?
There's kind of a theoretical argument that if you have a really weak immune system, if you get vaccinated too early, the immunity wears off by the time, you know, if there's a late flu season, say February or March, you know, you might not have your full immunity at that point. That's a big argument against being vaccinated in August, for instance. But most people say by September, September is an okay time to be vaccinated, and October is ideal. That's really where we make our big push, because we almost never see influenza activity before November. And if we see an outbreak this year, it will probably be late. And in terms of Jefferson Healthcare not having the supply, it's entirely out of their control. You know, everybody orders their vaccine like 6 months ago. So they're completely dependent on whatever the manufacturer delivers it to them. And it looks like the pharmacies got it first. But they will get it. There is no shortage of vaccine, and so, you know, everyone who wants to get vaccinated will be able to. What we're really concerned about this year is a surge in COVID during the winter months, because all of the things that tend to bring on flu season also apply for COVID-19. You know, as we're indoors more often and closer together, and there's holidays and family gatherings, all of those things are going to promote transmission of COVID-19. So that's what we're really bracing for. I did note one KPTZ question was, they were asking, you know, if they had a family member who tested positive and everyone's gone through the appropriate isolation and quarantine, and is there anything else they need to do? And the answer is no. You know, once you're, you know, out of isolation, and once you're past your quarantine period, and you generally we test everyone in quarantine, so people test negative, you're done with it. And we don't actually recommend, we still don't recommend antibody testing after you have the infection, because we really don't know what it means. We don't know how long immunity lasts after infection. And so, I mean, the test is available. People who want to pay for it can get it. But it's very hard for us to interpret. We do think at this point people have immunity for at least 3 months after they develop COVID-19. But beyond that, we're just not sure.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Locke. Any other questions for Dr. Locke before we pass it on to Mr. Bentz? There was one other question in KPTZ about if there's any update about the, I forget what Harrison's renamed, St. What's it in Kitsap County?
Yeah, St. Michael is now their name. And that has now, fortunately that appears to be under control. So they're on the downside of it. I think the case count was in the mid-40s. I don't have it off the top of my head, but it mostly hospital staff but a significant number of patients, even some visitors. So that was the largest hospital outbreak for COVID-19 so far in Washington State, which is a distinction that no hospital wants to have. Dr. Unthank and I had a big meeting with the Kitsap County Health Officer on Friday, and grilling him on all the sort of lessons learned, because we want anything we can extract from their experience and use to prevent that from happening in Clallam and Jefferson County, we want to do. That's how you progress. So we've been watching that really closely. And the only good thing about a hospital outbreak is you generally know who's been exposed, because they have really detailed records of who were visitors and who were patients. So we don't have evidence that it's spilled out into the general community. We do have Jefferson County cases that were linked to that. Not patients, but staff members. People that work at St. Michael but live in Jefferson County. They were among the people that were infected. And we, because they were Jefferson County residents, we managed those cases locally. But that now appears to be over. But they'll keep doing, you know, rigorous testing until they, you know, they're absolutely certain that there's no undiagnosed cases that they've missed.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Locke. If there's no last questions, we'll turn it over to Willie. Yeah, take it away.
All right, thanks, Commissioner. First part of my report is just a follow-up on what I talked about a little bit last week with regards to the changes in FEMA guidance about Stafford Act funding. Another refresher to all the listeners, the Stafford Act is what's used when the president declares a national emergency. It opens a pathway for funding to local jurisdictions to help reimburse them for their response costs. The latest FEMA policy guidance on Stafford Act funding for this event, which actually goes into effect formally tomorrow, is a little bit topsy-turvy from what the Stafford Act has traditionally, the role it's traditionally played during major responses. Whereas typically the Stafford Act reimburses you for things like debris cleanup, operating emergency shelters, the overtime for all your response staff. It's still covering some of those things, but whereas typically the Stafford Act is kind of the first place you go for funding, and then you look to fill in some of your gaps for other federal funding sources, other state funding sources, et cetera, the latest FEMA policy guidance describes Stafford Act funding as the last resort, and it's really advising local jurisdictions to look elsewhere as they're for their primary means of funding, which again is kind of a complete paradigm shift from what we've seen historically. FEMA is still going to pay for direct healthcare, a lot of healthcare costs. They're going to pay for PPE for first responders, law enforcement, fire, and EMS, healthcare workers, things like that. They're going to pay for mitigation efforts to protect against COVID-19 in facilities like fire stations here at the EOC and JEFCOM, public health, and places like that. But they're not going to be covering a wide range of activities that we thought were initially going to be covered. And you know, one such that they mentioned right in the policy document was contact tracing. One of the best tools, and Dr. Locke has been talking about this entire response, contact tracing is arguably one of the best, it is one of the best weapons we have in fighting COVID-19. And FEMA is asking us to look elsewhere to fund those critical activities. So they're working with all the other federal agencies to kind of try to look at the overall picture of what funding is available. And FEMA and the Stafford Act is taking a very big step back in what they're going to be offering us, which is it's certainly disappointing. Philip?
So, for example, facility changes within the courthouse that's separate from public health, separate from the sheriff's office, would that now be eligible under Stafford Act or ineligible?
That would be ineligible because you're not interacting with COVID suspected or positive. Even though at the courthouse, you're performing essential government services, you're interacting with the general public, and there's a risk that you're trying to mitigate. Because it's not direct interaction with COVID suspected or positives, that's not going to be eligible. We're going to have to look elsewhere to fund those still no less essential mitigation acts.
So that's a big change.
Yep. And so what we're doing right now is assessing both the PPE that we've distributed over the course of the response and who it's gone to, so who we might have to look for other funding sources for that PPE if they don't meet the new requirements. We're going to be looking at all of our previous FEMA reimbursement requests, previous activities. I mean, we'll obviously be connecting with Patty Charnas and Mark McCauley to discuss how this will interplay with CARES Act funding. So we just kind of digested this new guidance last week and are starting to put some of our new numbers together to again make sure that we really leverage the funding that's available to its best possible ability, because this does represent such a change to the way FEMA's and the Stafford Act funding, the role it's traditionally played.
Now, commissioners, you may already be aware, but even some costs that may potentially be Stafford Act eligible, we have been having difficulty collecting on, and Vicki can elaborate on this. But for example, Dr. Locke's additional costs directly to address COVID have been submitted for a number of months. For several months worth to FEMA, and they have so far been balking on reimbursing those costs. They haven't said no yet, but they certainly haven't said yes. And so that gives you a sense of just how tightly FEMA is turning down the spigot on the flow of Stafford Act funds. And you may recall, just through October 31st, we had estimated about $247,000 worth of county expenses that we thought would be a direct COVID response cost that we thought would be Stafford Act eligible, and that we were counting on Stafford Act. We are in the process this week of recalculating that and how much of that and a substantial portion will need now to come out of coronavirus relief funds instead. So that's part of the work that Patty Charnas and Mark McCauley will be briefing you on a little bit later this morning.
Great. And really, I mean, not that this really matters, but any idea other than just the pandemic, you know, being everywhere, why FEMA in the middle of an emergency has done this about face? I mean, is this a political fallout of taking FEMA dollars for different uses?
So, this is FEMA. Every single major disaster, they always do release clarification and change in policy on what the Stafford Act's going to require. So every disaster ends up being different, and FEMA recognizes that. So they're flexible with Stafford Act funding, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. So there always is changes in the middle of the disaster. That's nothing new. As far as this kind of somewhat drastic of a change, I do think there are political machinations behind it. So I think you were a little bit on the nose in that there has been some raiding of the FEMA reserve funds. I do think that some folks saw how much was contributing to the coronavirus relief fund, and they see that as, well, they're already getting federal funding, so let's pull this back a little bit, trying to maybe balance it out, when in reality, we need all the help that we can get. So this is nothing new for FEMA to release clarifications, to change guidance, normally to try to best suit the needs of the local communities. But again, given the fact that this is such a wide range of disaster, given the fact that it's going on for so long and that's still not 100% sure what the true cost is going to ultimately be. And then again, the politics in Washington are also playing a role. So a combination of those three things.
Great.
So that's it for me on the FEMA and COVID front. Wanted to talk a little bit more about fires and smoke. I heard Commissioner Brotherton mention the airnow.gov site. You know, I mentioned last week wasmoke.blogspot.com, another great resource that links to AirNow and has some additional resources on how to mitigate against the smoke hazard. The KPDZ question for us this week was, you know, kind of how to prepare for wildfires as a whole. I'm in our community SITREP a little bit later this evening. We'll have some additional links on what you can do, some more information. Basically, in short, one of the, you know, best things you do is just have a go kit to be ready to evacuate, even though we're not under any current evacuation orders in Jefferson County. It's always a good idea to have your go kit updated. The thing about the go kit is I know a lot of our emergency kits are very large. They might be in big plastic bins or old garbage cans or something like that. A go kit should be mobile in case you do have to evacuate on a moment's notice. So it might be a little smaller subsection of your larger kit, something in a backpack that you can throw in the car and take with you that has some clothes, some food, some water, some emergency medication, copies of emergency paperwork, maybe a book to keep you entertained in case you get bored, all that kind of fun stuff. And the second thing, and we'll include a link to this today on our SITREP, is kind of knowing your fire danger. It obviously varies greatly given the large geographic landscape and the differences within our counties. So know what your specific fire dangers are. And then knowing that, you can actually take some steps around your own home to reduce fire danger. So there's a program called FireWise that, again, we'll also include links to. It talks about how you can build defensible space around your home and actually reduce the direct fire danger immediately in your immediate vicinity. So there are some mitigation efforts you can take, again, right there in your own home to protect. And finally, one of the questions that we've been getting quite a bit is, if we do have to evacuate, where do we go? And the easiest answer to that is away from the fire danger. Most people aren't looking for that direct response. They specifically want to know, where's the shelter going to be? And it's one thing that the American Red Cross, who's the federal co-lead in mass care and sheltering, they don't like to pre-identify shelters. Now, they do have agreements with lots of different buildings to be shelters, but they don't like to publicize them beforehand, because the last thing we want is someone to have a shelter location in their mind and they go there and it turns out that that location was unsafe and there was actually a difference about a change in where they were going to go. So shelters might be at any number of schools, churches, fairgrounds, community centers, etc. But if you know you might have to evacuate, really, the first thing is going to be move away from that fire danger, and that fire danger can depend on, the wind, where the fire's moving, what specifically burning, what the fuel types are, the time of year, lots of different factors. So just be prepared to be flexible and just move away from that fire danger and await further instructions. Oftentimes when you're evacuating, you will be given a place to go in the evacuation notice. Other times it's going to be, the fire's in this area, please get somewhere else. Typically, we'll look to open up what's called an evacuation center, and that just is a place to go in the interim before a full-fledged shelter is open. Of course, during COVID-19, it's unlikely we'll look at a large congregate shelter with everyone living together. Right now, what the Red Cross is doing is looking at putting up people who have to evacuate in hotels instead. Up until it reaches maybe a certain point, then they'll look at a congregate facility. But they are, again, trying to mitigate against COVID-19 by not placing folks all together. It's also recommended, too, staying in a shelter. A disaster shelter is not particularly fun. It's crowded, it's noisy, the cots are uncomfortable. So for those of you who want to do some wildfire planning, I'd look to see if you have maybe friends in Squim or PA, maybe Silverdale, Poolsville, Bremerton, one to the east, one to the west, and maybe talk to them about being your cap point. So if you do have to evacuate out of the area, you have two escape options and then a friend to go stay with in the interim. But again, be prepared to be flexible during evacuations. Listen to authorities, tune into KPTZ for more info, and last but not least, sign up for our emergency text alert system. There's information on our website. You can also just text JEFCO, D-E-M, to 888-777 and sign up automatically, and that will be a great source of emergency information directly from us. So again, a lot of this information will be in our community FitRep a little bit later.